The Story of Music, written and read by Howard Goodall. Introduction. Perhaps your favourite music was written by Monteverdi in 1600, Bach in 1700, Beethoven in 1800, Elgar in 1900, or Coldplay in 2000. Whichever it is, it's a sobering fact that everything that had to be discovered to produce that music, its chords, melodies, and rhythms, had already been discovered by around 1450. Of course, I don't necessarily mean the instruments people used or the countless quirky creative decisions that make each song, concerto or opera, sound distinct and characterful, but rather the raw material, the building blocks of music. In order for Mozart to thrill audiences with just three dramatic chords at the start of his opera Don Giovanni, someone had to come up with the idea of playing more than one note at a time. In order for Gershwin to give his song Summertime its enchanting seesaw accompaniment, with the high solo voice gliding in way above it, someone had to work out the alchemy of harmony and the seductive lilt of rhythm. And in order for me to sit at a piano and play those two masterworks in the comfort of my own home, instantly and just as the composer intended, someone had to work out a way of writing the notes down, alongside performance instructions. Indeed, it's easy to overlook how utterly spoiled for musical choice we are in the 21st century. We can listen to almost anything we want at the press of a button. But as recently as the late 19th century, even the most devoted music lover might hear his or her favourite piece just three or four times in his or her whole life. Unless you happen to be a virtuoso musician with access to both sheet music and instruments, it was almost impossible to bring large-scale forms of music into your own home. Not until the dawn of recording and radio technology did our ancestors have any great choice as to what they listened to and when. If you like, it's only since recorded music has been available to buy that music has become democratic, something that everyone can influence and participate in by showing their preference for one song or one style of music over another. Inevitably, though, this democratisation brought along with it its own new problems. Once, musical fashion and taste were dictated by a few wealthy patrons and institutions, who might, in prosperous times, allow composers some degree of freedom to experiment without fear of starvation. But what became known as the popular age unexpectedly threw up a division between modernist music in the classical tradition and contemporary music of a more accessible kind. Even within the classical tradition, the weight of the past bore down heavily on living composers, as the vast repository of old music was recorded and rediscovered. Classical music might well have died out entirely had composers not turned their resentment into resourcefulness and reconnected with audiences by cross-pollinating with other genres. Modern film music is just one example of classically inspired sounds being aligned with popular art forms of the present day. This instinct to adapt and move with the flow has been particularly vehement and particularly necessary in the past 100 years or so, but it's always been a fact of musical life. If composers of all eras had been unwilling to learn, invent, borrow, and even steal, we might still be listening to plain chant. Collectively, they made the mainstream sounds of contemporary Western music possible. What we call Western music, the medium in which nearly all music on earth is now conceived, recorded and performed, and which has, in the past 100 years or so, absorbed into its fold most of the other music cultures of the world, started out as merely one localised branch of a global musical map. European Mediterranean tribes had their particular brand of music, much as African, Asian, American and Antipodean tribes did, and still do. What became the generic category Western music was an amalgam of, among others, Egyptian, Persian, Greek, Celtic, Norse, and Roman strands of music. It started, though, just like all the world's traditional music cultures, improvised, shared, spontaneous, and transient. The other great musical cultures of the world, because they continued to be improvised, oral traditions, handed down from parent to child, have carried on to the present day much as they had for millennia. Indonesian and Balinese music, for instance, can still be heard in forms that have remained unashamedly unchanged for centuries. The branch of music that thrived from Iceland to the Caspian Sea, though, did not stand still. A series of revolutions took place that gave it remarkable new capabilities. This is not to say that Western music, as we have inherited it, is better than, say, Indonesian music. Rather, it's an unavoidable historical truth that the Western branch of musical activity developed in ways that were not paralleled in other musical cultures. Gradually, but with a great spirit of determination and invention, the language and method of Western music became universal standards that could be adapted to accommodate, so it now seems, every musical idea on earth. And yet the telling of music's extraordinary unfolding story is, for anyone more or less who hasn't taken a degree in it, a mystery. Worse, it seems to be a deliberate mystery, shrouded in arcane jargon and bewildering categorization, the shrine and preserve of a club of privileged insiders. We have inherited a series of inaccurate and confusing historic labels by which classical music is catalogued, almost none of which describes what was actually happening in music at the time. Take the Renaissance, rebirth, a period between about 1450 and 1600, in which art, architecture, philosophy, and social attitudes made enormous leaps forward. While it is true that music underwent its own transformation in this period, its greatest revolutions, the invention of notation, of metrical organisation, of harmony, and of instrument construction, had already taken place during what was, in many other aspects of life, the long, dark, ignorant night of the Middle Ages. The chief movers and shakers of the Renaissance, none of whom, by the way, was a musician, were inspired by the example of ancient Rome and Greek classical civilization. Although it's not until the later 18th century that we come to the classical era in music, which has inconveniently lent its name to the entire branch of Western music that isn't popular. Between the two, we have the Baroque era, characterized by gaudy excess and decorative indulgence in art, but by purity and economy in music. Then there is the chaotic mislabeling of the notes themselves. Music's longest duration note, for instance, is called a breve, meaning short. A breve can be subdivided into four minims, meaning shortest of all, even though it can be further broken down into up to eight subdivisions. The note known as quaver in English is in French called a croche, the anglicisation of which, crotchet, has come to mean a note of double the value of a croche. The Germans and Americans call two crotchets a half note, while the French call half a croche a double croche, a crotchet a noir, black, and a minim, a blanche, white, even though they're not the same as the black and white notes on a keyboard. The list goes on. Anachronisms and blind alleys blight all the road signs classical music has given itself. I'll tackle them one by one as we progress and attempt to unpick the tangled knot of confusion that they've left in their wake. More than anything, though, my story of music focuses on the changing sounds and innovations of the music itself, as it has occurred chronologically, rather than on musicians who had a high profile simply because they had a high profile. Of course, it was often the big-name composers who brought about musical revolutions, but sometimes the agents of change were obscure men and women whose names are not carved in the decorative panels of the world's concert halls. They will all be represented as part of the vast jigsaw of Western music. There are already plenty of books out there that can tell you what Beethoven had hidden under his piano or what killed Elvis. I am only interested in either of them if they brought about musical change. You'll see in due course whether either or both of them qualify. While the primary focus of this book is the uniquely rapid progress of Western music, it will necessarily and freely dip into the concepts and techniques of other musical cultures, and unashamedly oscillate between popular, folk, and art music styles. At its heart lies a mission to retell the history of music in such a way that normal music lovers can relate to it. My resolve to do so is fortified by the belief that music, when all is said and done, is a unity, and that the divisions we place between periods and categories are often artificial. Musicians who play a variety of styles every day of their lives, transferring their skills across genres as a matter of course, take this as a given. It's high time this truth was shared with everyone else. The story of music, successive waves of discoveries, breakthroughs, and inventions, is an ongoing process. The next great leap forward may take place in a back street of Beijing or in a basement rehearsal space in Gateshead. Whatever music you adore, Monteverdi or Mantovani, Mozart or Motown, Masho or Mashup, the techniques it relies on did not happen by accident. Someone somewhere thought of them first. To tell this story, we need to clear our minds of the complicated cacophony that makes up our daily soundtrack and try to imagine how revolutionary, how exhilarating, and, yes, even how utterly bewildering so many of the innovations we take for granted today were to the people who witnessed their birth. Not that long ago, music was a rare and feeble whisper in a wilderness of silence. Now it is as ubiquitous as the air we breathe. How on earth did that miracle happen? Chapter 1. The Age of Discovery, 40,000 BC to AD 1450. You may think that music is a luxury, a plug-in to make human life more enjoyable. That would be a fair supposition in the 21st century, but our hunter-gatherer ancestors wouldn't have agreed. To them, music was much more than mere entertainment. The famous rock paintings in Chauvet, France, made by cave-dwelling people of the Upper Paleolithic period, or European Ice Age, are 32,000 years old. They are among the oldest surviving examples of human art ever found anywhere in the world, although, like other cave paintings, they mostly depict animals and the odd symbolically fertile female figures. These were, after all, people who daily diced with extinction. It's thought that the paintings were created and venerated as part of a ritual, and we now know that music of some kind played an important part in these rituals, since whistles and flutes made from bone have been found in many Paleolithic caves. A particularly ancient find was a flute made of bear bone, discovered in a Slovenian cave in 1995, which was dated at roughly 41,000 BC. More impressive still, in May 2012, a joint team from Oxford and Tübingen universities unearthed flutes made from mammoth ivory and bird bones at Geissenklerteler Cave in the Swabian Jura region of southern Germany, carbon dated at between 43,000 and 42,000 BC, making them the oldest musical instruments ever discovered. They may be simple in sound and limited in range, like tiny penny whistles, but it's nevertheless from dusty artefacts such as these that Duke Ellington's horn section and the massed woodwind of the Berlin Philharmonic would one day grow. Although these deceptively simple ancient flutes are almost all that survives of Paleolithic music, acoustic scientists have recently made an extraordinary discovery about the life-saving importance of music to cave dwellers of this period. In 2008, researchers from the University of Paris ascertained that the Chauvet paintings, which lie within huge, inaccessible, pitch-black networks of tunnels, are located at the points of greatest resonance in the cave network. From these special points, then, human voices would carry, echoing and ricocheting, throughout the whole subterranean system. It has been suggested that people would sing not just as an adjunct to communal ritual, but more crucially, as a bat-like form of sonar to provide location bearings in the vast labyrinth of the cave, rather like a musical sat-nav. Our own day-to-day survival may no longer depend on our ability to sing, but our ancient ancestors were onto something that applies to modern lives too. Study after study around the world has shown that singing enables infants to train their brains and memories, to recognise pitch differentiation as a preparation for the full development of spatial awareness. In the Paleolithic age, this was an absolutely crucial skill. If survival depended on knowing from which direction a wild animal's cry was coming, what size it was, and what mood it might be in. But even now, singing and the mastery of pitch play a large part in a child's development of language. For an infant in China, for example, pitch recognition is an essential building block of language. But in all languages, it is certain that sound modulations enable us to enhance the sophistication, tone, and meaning of our words. Even though we now know that early music played an important part in ritual, communication, and language development, piecing together a coherent picture of our early musical past is a notoriously difficult task because musical notation was not a common practice until much later. Fortunately, we do have evidence of music's perennial importance to public and private life. The considerable body of art left to posterity by the ancient Egyptians, for instance, shows us that by their time, 3100 to 670 BC, the playing of music was closely associated with the exercise of power and homage, with religious and secular rituals, and with state ceremony, dancing, love, and death. These pieces of art depict a variety of instruments, from the simple sistrum or sekhem, a handheld, U-shaped, shaken percussion instrument, to harps, ceremonial horns, flutes, and wind instruments whose sound is made by blowing across strips of reed, the same technique that produces the sound of the modern oboe, bassoon, and clarinet families. They also depict expert performers of high status, including members of royal dynasties and deities. The prevalence of music in ancient Egyptian life is demonstrated by the fact that over a quarter of all the tombs at the necropolis found at the site of the city of Thebes are decorated with iconography of music-making of one sort or another. The Egyptians were not alone in their reverence for the power of music. Psalms sung by the priests of King David, who united the kingdoms of Israel and Judea in 1003 BC, are riven through with references to instruments and to singing. The Greek word psalm itself, strictly speaking, refers to a religious song with accompaniment by plucked stringed instrument. In one psalm alone, number 150, tof, timbrel or tambourine, hazosera, trumpet, shofar, horn, kinnor, triangular frame harp or lyre, nebel, psaltery, ugav, possibly a type of organ or alternatively a flute, meziltayim, cymbals, and minim, an unspecified group of stringed instruments, are invoked in praise of God. The Psalms of David, Sefer Tehillim, Book of Praises in Hebrew, are still sung today to more recent melodies. As such, they can claim to be the oldest continually performed tradition of religious singing in human history. David's successor, Solomon, set up a music school attached to the temple at Jerusalem for the training of musicians. And yet, we have absolutely no idea what this music sounded like. Nor do we know what the music of the earlier Sumerian civilization sounded like, circa 4500 to 1940 BC, nor that of the Egyptians, nor, save for a few tiny fragments of tunes, that of the more recent ancient Greeks, circa 800 to 146 BC. The informative paintings and impressive pyramids of the ancient Egyptians have survived remarkably well, but their music has disappeared completely. They simply had no way of writing it down for us. The ancient Greeks, to be fair to them, did at least leave a few tantalizingly scattered remains of a form of musical notation, the most complete example being some lines engraved on a first-century burial tomb. This epitaph of Psychilos has an accompanying decipherable tune that lasts about 10 seconds in all. But in general, it just would not have occurred to them that having musical notation mattered. This is because the Greek musical tradition, like all the musical traditions of the ancient world, was one of improvisation. Setting music in stone, as it were, so that it stayed the same for each performance, year in and year out, would have struck them as a contradiction of music's function and enjoyment. They didn't need a musical notation. All of which is particularly frustrating for us, since we have so much evidence of the wonderful-looking instruments of the ancient world, but no way of bringing them to life. The oldest list of musical instruments ever discovered, including a few instructions on how to play them, was found on a clay tablet in Mesopotamia, modern Iraq, and dated to 2600 BC. The columns on the tablet are made up of cuneiform script detailing various instruments, including the kinnor, the handheld harp-like instrument that is alternatively known as a lyre. A slightly younger, old Babylonian clay tablet, dating from 2000 to 1700 BC, gives basic details on how to learn and tune a four-stringed fretted lute, including instructions for the notes to play. As such, it's the oldest form of decipherable notation, albeit very simple notation, in existence. Sadly, none of these lutes survives. But archaeologists have had moderate success in unearthing other ancient instruments in all corners of the globe. Several lyres and two harps dating from the same period as the Mesopotamian clay tablet were found at the large excavated royal burial site at the old city of Ur, known today as Tel el Mukayyah. One of the lyres is decorated with a golden bull's head, complete with large horns, and it was buried alongside the sacrificial body of its female player. In Egypt, equally impressive examples of the kind of instruments featured in ancient art have also been unearthed, notably a semicircular five-stringed harp found in the burial tomb of King Amenhotpa's priest Thouenanani, who was laid to rest in around 1350 BC. Around the same time in Sweden, in approximately 1000 BC, it would seem that people were playing brass instruments. Cave paintings from the king's grave at Kivik show a number of people playing, together, what look like curved horns. Horns of a similar shape and of roughly the same period survive to this day in the form of the Brudafelter lures, a set of six Bronze Age lures, carved brass horns, that were found in a field in Zealand, Denmark, in 1797. They were perfectly preserved and are still playable today. We even know how to play them because their mouthpieces correspond almost exactly with those of later horns. And while we once again have no way of knowing what sort of music was played on them, we know that their sound is loud and penetrating. In an unusual tribute to this intrinsically Danish instrument, one of the nation's most famous exports was named after it. Packets of lure pack butter still feature a pair of lures in their design. What the Brudafelter lures tell us is that it's a grave error to describe the musical activity of 800 BC as primitive, since these elaborate brass instruments could only have been the handiwork of culturally sophisticated people, warlike though they may also have been. It's important to bear in mind that these artifacts were made and played 500 years before the Romans conquered Europe. All across the continent and beyond it, people were constantly thinking up new and ingenious ways of making music. But of all the culturally sophisticated ancient civilizations that were playing and enjoying music in this period, there is one group that emerges head and shoulders above the rest. No civilization, except perhaps for our own, has valued, venerated, and taken pleasure in music more than the ancient Greeks, whose culture dominated southeastern Europe and the Near East for nearly 700 years in the first millennium BC, before it was absorbed into the Roman Empire. Even the word music comes from the Greek musica, referring to the fruits of the nine muses in literature, science, and the arts. There are three major things you need to know about the ancient Greeks and music, and this is before we take into account that they invented one of the most influential instruments of subsequent millennia, the organ. A physicist engineer named Ctesibios, who lived in Alexandria in the 3rd century BC, described and possibly even invented what was known as a hydraulis organ, which used a tank of water to pressurize the air for the pipes. The first major thing you need to know is that the Greeks believed music to be both a science and an art, and that they developed theories and systems for music accordingly. Pythagoras was but one of a host of philosopher-scientists who tried to figure out what music was and how it might relate to the laws of the natural world, especially its relationship to the heavenly bodies of the planets and stars. Greek theorists called the orbiting motions they observed in the night sky the music of the spheres. And this curiosity about music is something the classical era Greeks wanted to instill in younger generations. When they more or less gave birth to the systematic education of young people, it's worth noting that their first compulsory seven subjects were grammar, rhetoric, logic, maths, geometry, astronomy, and music. Much later, but nonetheless inspired by the Greeks, the world's first universities, Al-Karayouin in Fez, Morocco, AD 859, Bologna, 1088, and Oxford, circa 1096, included music in the basic diet of subjects they taught. The Greeks believed that studying music would produce better, more tolerant, and nobler human beings. Plato declared in The Republic that musical training is a more potent instrument than any other because rhythm and harmony find their way into the inward places of the soul, on which they mightily fasten, imparting grace and making the soul of him who is rightly educated graceful. Young students were accordingly expected to learn an instrument and perform music daily alongside gymnastics. Greek philosophies on the beneficial behavioural qualities of music find striking parallels with Confucius-influenced writings of the 2nd and 3rd centuries BC in China. Chinese belief in the potential of music, yu, to improve and refine the human condition was so pronounced that in the Zhou and early Han dynasties, the control of musical activity was enshrined in a specific government department. Like their contemporaries in Greece, the Han Chinese saw virtue in the relationship between musical pitch in music, the relative distance between notes, and the arrangement of the stars and planets they observed above them. Thousands of pages of theory and instruction survive, detailing how it might be possible through careful calculation, through manipulation of the calendar, through codifying the elements of music, and through study of the cosmos, to formulate good governance, based on the correct alignment of these associated forces. The second major thing about the Greeks and music is that they treated it as an essential part of all their significant rituals. Aristides Quintilianus, who lived sometime between the 1st and 3rd centuries AD, reported of Greek life that, "To be sure, there is no action among men that is carried out without music. Sacred hymns and offerings are adorned with music. Specific feasts and the festive assemblies of cities exult in it. Wars and marches are both aroused and composed through music. It makes sailing and rowing and the most difficult of the handicrafts not burdensome by providing an encouragement for the work." The ancient Greeks reserved their greatest excitement in relation to music, though, for competitions, of which they had a large number. Everyone knows that the ancient Greeks invented the Olympic Games. For the Greeks, though, it wasn't just running, nude wrestling, and hurling the javelin that were important. The earliest Olympic Games were religious as well as athletic festivals, and as such would have included some music-making. But a distinct tradition of singing competitions grew up separately and attracted participants from all over the Greek-dominated eastern Mediterranean. Singer-songwriters would gather for festivals and sing their homespun songs for the benefit of a panel of judges and a live audience. Yes, even the X Factor is a 3,000-year-old format. The earliest recorded contest took place at Chalcis in around 700 BC, the poet Hesiod proudly penning a few lines in celebration of his winning a solo singing class there. The Spartan city of Carnea hosted a long series of knockout talent shows for singers accompanying themselves on the kithara, a form of lyre. In 670 BC, one such competition was won by Terpander, a bardic musician and kithara expert who's said to have died from choking on a fig thrown by an admirer at a concert. There were also choral competitions, with a festival atmosphere and plenty of group choreography, ancient versions, if you like, of the present-day carnivals in Rio de Janeiro, Trinidad and Notting Hill. The significance of these competitions is that they prompted the emergence of a new class of elite musicians, individuals and groups striving for musical excellence who could earn money and prizes for their endeavours. Freakishly talented children were paraded at these events, much as they have been ever since. Hitherto, music had been something anyone and everyone might participate in, a communal activity, like the singing of a tribe in the bush. The Greeks began a process that became unusually pronounced in Western music, emphasis on a VIP class of performers whose brilliance was intended to strike awe and enchantment into the hearts of the ordinary listener. The third thing you need to know about the Greeks and music is that by inventing European drama, they in effect invented the musical, since their dramas were all accompanied by music and choral singing, declaiming, close to the modern notion of rapping, or chanting. Their surviving amphitheatres, dotted around the eastern Mediterranean, are among the most vivid reminders to us of the artistic sophistication of their civilization. Whereas we consider the roles of writer, poet, director, actor, dancer, singer, and composer to be distinct professions, the lines were rather more blurred in ancient Greece, with many leading dramatists fulfilling many or all of these functions. The extent to which drama and music were deemed inseparable by the Greeks, an ideal sought time and again in later centuries by opera composers, is suggested by the fact that the word orchestra is the Greek term for the performing area in their theatrical amphitheatres. A number of noteworthy Greek dramas are even about music. The plot of Aristophanes' satirical play The Frogs of 405 BC, for instance, like the story of Orpheus and Eurydice, concerns a life-or-death poetry and singing competition in the underworld. And it was Greek comedies such as this one, as well as Greek tragedies, that inspired the dreaming up in Italy in around 1600 of the concept of a sung form of theatre, opera. It's fitting that the first great opera, composed by Monteverdi in 1607, features a hero faced with a life-or-death singing challenge in the underworld, Orfeo. That said, I suspect that the scale and popularity of these amphitheatre dramas among ordinary folk in ancient Greece and Sparta, and their origin in choral and religious festivals, puts them closer as an experience to Handel's theatre-filling 18th-century oratorios, such as his Messiah, or even the 20th-century musical, a form that more often than not created a story out of songs, in contrast to opera, which tended to create songs from a story. But in the absence of surviving notation of the music performed with the plays of Aristophanes and others, we must once again resign ourselves to frustration and speculation. Hellenistic culture was in due course absorbed into that of the Roman Empire, and though we can see from paintings, friezes, and pottery that the Romans were surrounded by music and its trappings, they too had no compulsion to write it down. The one great thing we do know about the Romans and music is that they had a particular penchant for the organ, which featured as musical accompaniment for gladiatorial contests and other large-scale public entertainments. They had, of course, inherited the technology from Ctesibios's hydraulis organ, and the name organum likewise comes from the Greek organon, meaning instrument or tool. The oldest surviving example of the hydraulis organ was discovered in 1931 in the Roman city of Aquincum, modern Budapest, and dates from AD 228. But it was during this same century, the 3rd century AD, that the Greco-Roman method of using water to compress the air was replaced by a system of leather bellows, the prototypes of all subsequent bellows-fed organs. What the Romans played on their organs is, of course, a matter of conjecture. The vast body of written material left to us from the Roman era suggests to us that if they had developed some form of notation, some fragment or mention of it would surely have survived, but it has not. Consequently, their music is as deathly silent as the empty rooms of Pompeii. Almost. One fragile musical thread did survive the collapse of Greco-Roman civilization, given impetus by what seemed at first to be insignificant events in a troublesome frontier territory. This was the unstable puppet kingdom of Judea, or what we now call Palestine and Israel. In the embers of the last days of the Roman Empire, we are able, out of centuries of silence, to hear the only living musical bequest of the ancient world. In the year AD 70, the Roman army, exasperated by years of rebellion in Judea, sacked the city of Jerusalem and destroyed the Israelites' temple there. This succeeded in silencing a tradition that had been maintained for perhaps as long as 1,000 years, that of chanting Hebrew psalms in the temple. But the interruption was only temporary. For one thing, the tradition of chanting, if not the Hebrew chants themselves, was in due course taken on by the splinter sect of Christianity. It was originally supposed that the earliest Christian gatherings must have been heavily influenced by the synagogue services they replaced, But recent scholarship has shown that Christian chant developed from hymn singing rather than from psalms, and that it was different in character, probably intentionally, from its Jewish predecessor. Caution has to be applied to these conclusions in the absence of any surviving Jewish psalmody from before the destruction of the temple. But what is clear is that in the 700-year period during which Jewish chant fell into neglect, Christian chant spread vigorously. It was substantially reinforced when the religion became legal and was openly practiced following the Edict of Milan in AD 313. The gradual retreat of Roman military and administrative authority across Western Europe between 300 and 400 AD left behind a chaotic, fragmented picture. But it's an exaggeration to conclude that all culture disappeared with the Romans and that the Europeans were left rummaging around in a sea of ignorance and brutality, with a few isolated monastic settlements holding civilization together. For a start, it very much depends on which Europeans you're talking about. The Kingdom of Armenia, for example, established Christianity as its official religion in 301, and Armenians held on to their religious independence even when they were subsumed into the later Persian and Arabic empires. Etchmiadzin Cathedral was completed in 303 under the supervision of St. Gregory the Illuminator, and can claim to be the oldest purpose-built state church on earth, all earlier places of worship having been adapted from existing religious buildings, including Roman and Jewish temples. Etchmiadzin Cathedral still stands today, an impressive rebuttal to the notion that the period following the fall of Rome meant the temporary end of civilization. An even more spectacular architectural contradiction of the phrase Dark Ages is the Hagia Sophia Basilica in modern Istanbul, then Constantinople, the construction of which began in 537, and whose breathtaking dome, mostly redesigned and shored up in the 560s, was unsurpassed in its grandeur and ingenuity for nearly 1,000 years. Indeed, all that happened as Roman power retreated from Western and Northern Europe was that its civilization relocated to Constantinople, which continued to be a place of cultural magnificence for hundreds of years. The singing of psalms and hymns and the training up of singers to do so may have been low down on the list of priorities in the anarchic wasteland of France or England immediately after the withdrawal of Roman imperial administration, but the church in Rome itself set up its school of singing, Schola Cantorum, in 350, and there was plenty of musical activity going on in the Eastern Byzantine Empire too. Subsequent hostilities between Eastern and Western powers have blinded us to the fact that the European civilization we have gratefully inherited was nurtured, enriched, and developed in places that now are associated with the Arabic, Islamic, and Eastern Orthodox world. We know chanting or religious singing of some kind was alive and well in the Byzantine half of Europe in at least the 3rd and 4th centuries, because something of it even survives in a written-down form. In the papyrology collection of the Sackler Library at the University of Oxford is the world's oldest surviving Christian hymn, featuring a form of now undecipherable notation. It was excavated by Oxford archaeologists at the partially buried city of Oxyrhynchus in Egypt in the late 19th century. Thanks to these excavations and others, the Sackler Library contains the largest collection of ancient classical manuscripts on earth. The Oxyrhynchus hymn, written in ancient Greek, dates from the late 3rd century, making it nearly 2,000 years old. Meanwhile, in northern and western Europe, the waning of Roman influence provoked a wave of local wars as tribes fought for territorial supremacy. But these tribes were not all barbarian, in the generic sense that they were illiterate, marauding hooligans. At the burial site of the early 7th century Anglo-Saxon king Redwald, in Sutton Hoo in Suffolk, for example, along with all manner of cultural treasures, clothes, jewellery, weapons and so on, are the remains of a large six-stringed lyre, a form of handheld harp that is comparable to those of the ancient world. Of course, we don't know what the music played on this lyre sounded like, even though we can strum its strings and admire its craftsmanship. We don't know whether it occurred to its strummers to play more than one string simultaneously, like a chord, or whether they only picked out one note at a time tunes. Likewise, even though we know that in early 7th century China, orchestras of instruments played together, what they played is guesswork. It is possible, though, to reconstruct, to some extent, the chants that were being sung in churches and abbeys from around the 4th century onwards, from manuscripts of various kinds. Even where the primitive notation used was crude or unclear, the same chants continued to be sung without significant alteration into the period when reliable notation did exist. The incredible thing is that for the first few hundred years of the first millennium AD, before a universal notation system emerged, all of the chant that monks and nuns sang was memorized. It was passed on orally, monk by monk, nun by nun, painstakingly, patiently, for century after century. This chant, also called plain chant or plain song, has by default often been described as Gregorian chant, after Gregory the Great, who was Pope at the end of the 6th century. It is beautiful, ancient, mysterious, and in its incredible test of human memory, miraculous. What it is not, we now know, is anything to do with Pope Gregory. Indeed, plainsong developed gradually and separately all over Christian Europe according to local tastes and traditions. There was Gallican chant in France, Ambrosian chant in northern Italy, Beneventan chant in southern Italy, Mozarabic chant in Spain, and Sarum chant in the British Isles, Roman Sarum becoming in the 13th century the modern English city of Salisbury. But what all this chant had in common was that it was one memorised meandering tune with no accompaniment and no harmonising, the Greek term for which is monophonic, one voice. Plain chant is our only audible link with the musicians of the first 1,000 years AD. Its survival into the modern era we owe to two gigantic musical discoveries that began to make their presence felt in the 2 centuries before AD 1000. To grasp the significance of these two discoveries, we need to transport ourselves back to the sound world of that period, 1,500 years ago. It is a Sunday morning service in an abbey or cathedral. Some monks are singing a section of plain chant together in unison. After a couple of lifetimes, someone thinks it would be a good idea to add some young lads to the choir, to feed and clothe them and keep them out of mischief, and to begin the long, slow process of teaching them, from memory, the entire plainsong repertoire for the church year. The musical effect of adding the boys is that there are now 2 parallel lines of music, not just one, since the boys' voices are higher than those of the men. The higher version the boys sing is made up of identical notes to the men's, but at a higher register. So there is a fixed, natural distance between the 2 identical lines of music. This fixed distance between a note and its higher self is something that occurs in nature. We humans didn't invent it. We just found it to be lurking behind all musical sounds. I can tease out this secret natural relationship between a note and its higher self by illustrating the magic of musical pitch. If I pluck any string on a guitar or blow across the end of any piece of tubing, the length of the string or the length of the column of air will determine how high or low my note will be. We can call that note anything we like, but we may as well call it A. And when we talk about how high or low A sounds, we are talking about its pitch. If you twang a rubber band, it will make one pitch. If you stretch it so that it's longer and tighter, the pitch of the note will have changed. In ancient music making, pitch was fixed, defined, only by the length of your string or pipe, hence the need for a label like A to denote the same sound made on different shaped instruments. Nowadays, we are able to fix pitch using an electronic measurement, Hertz, which gives each pitch a numerical value, though we have stuck with the alphabetical names for ease of use. As an aside, the A that modern orchestras use as a reference to tune to, usually played by the oboe, was set at a sound wave frequency of 440 Hz by international agreement in the 1930s, having previously been standardised in some countries at the slightly lower 435 Hz. Before electricity made any of this possible, A could be different pitches not just in different countries, but also from town to town, or even from instrument to instrument. Surviving organs and other instruments from Bach's time indicate that the average pitch was lower then than it is today, so his music is mostly performed at A equals 415 Hz. Likewise, the music of Mozart and Haydn is sometimes played at the historically authentic frequency of A equals 430 Hz. Here's the magical bit. If I pluck my guitar string again, but this time ever so gently resting my finger halfway down its length, it plays a higher version of note A. Let's call it little a. If I fill half my pipe or tube with water, effectively halving the instrument's length, the new note that sounds when I blow across its top will also be little a. Little a and big A were both there all the time, but it just took a bit of teasing to get little a to reveal itself. In fact, every time you hear big A, you are also hearing little a hidden within it, as it is part of big A's rainbow spectrum of sound. In musical terms, we say that little a is an octave higher than big A, and that big A is an octave lower than little a. This natural distance was originally named octave, meaning eight, because in the medieval church there were only eight notes to choose from, with one of these octave notes at either end of the eight. From the ancient Greeks to the Reformation, it was believed that certain musical notes had a dangerously seductive effect and needed to be outlawed by authority. This eight-note restriction was driven by the medieval church's desire to simplify and order the potential musical free-for-all. Later, octave came to mean a choice of 12 notes, not eight, and we got saddled with the wrong descriptor forever, but I'll explain that development when it arrives. For now, in the early Middle Ages, octave meaning eight is a fair definition of the relationship between big A and little a. Men monks and boy choristers sang together, an octave apart, for a very long time. But this idea, having two notes for one, prompted a further revolutionary thought. What if we had two notes together that weren't an octave apart? Not just big A and little a, but big A and big E, for example. Believe it or not, this possibility didn't occur to medieval musicians for centuries. It was as if they discovered black and white, then maybe brown, but never thought to look for further colours. Indeed, the process of eking out those new notes took so long that we don't even know in which century it happened. Sometime before 800 is all I can tell you. This was a really major breakthrough, layering two lines of voices singing at the same time, but singing slightly different notes. And yet, when the musical monks finally started doing it, their caution was staggering. They took the original plain chant and added a second line that ran exactly in parallel to it at a slight distance, like two train tracks. Usually it was the note pitched five steps higher up the ladder, of eight, that they used for the new tracks. The reason for the singer's attraction to the pitch five steps up the scale, or four down if you're going in the descending direction, is that this pitch, like the octave, has a natural resonance in all sounds. We created little a by halving the length of our stretched guitar string. If we'd divided the length of the string by a third instead of a half, we would produce this very pitch. If we had started at A, we would now have E. These resonances are caused by a phenomenon known as the harmonic series, which we'll encounter in a later chapter. For now, it's enough to know that the notes at the fourth and fifth rung of the medieval musical ladder were derived from what were deemed perfect mathematical ratios, and were therefore the monks' first choice for their additional pitch. Medieval church musicians called the technique of running two notes in parallel, which they improvised on the spot, organum, because to their ears it sounded like an organ, which it does. The Greek term for more than one voice line singing together is polyphonic, many voices. Organum became very popular across Europe and, dare I say it, formulaic to the point of tedium. In around 800, you'd probably have heard it in any abbey you stumbled upon from Italy to Northumbria. But the heady excitement of turning one tune into two at no extra cost had another spin-off. Organum, where one voice stood still instead. This version has the basic plain chant as normal, but instead of adding another line following its contours like the parallel train tracks, the new additional line stays put. It just holds one long note throughout, a sound that is known as a drone. Holding the drone, however, turned out to be unusually boring to perform, not to mention quite tiring, so more often than not, it was played on an instrument instead. An organ, perhaps, or now almost forgotten instruments, such as the crwth, the psaltery, the hurdy-gurdy, or the symphony. These instruments shared the ability to regenerate a held note seemingly endlessly, without a break for breath or a change in fingering. A bow drawn backwards and forwards across a string, or a handle mechanism that turned the edge of a wheel against a string, were the most common solutions. An organ could keep going indefinitely as long as you had someone, or a team of people, to pump its bellows. The point of adding a drone to a chant melody was that new combinations of notes were created as the melody line moved closer or further away from the drone. If we imagine parallel organum as a train track winding across the landscape, the drone style looked more like a graph in which one line moves and the other stays constant. It's a concept that survives to this day in the music of the bagpipe. The instrument's ancient and surprising connection to plain song is preserved in the naming of its parts. The perforated tube you play the melody on is still called the chanter. As time went on, more adventurous musicians, such as the 9th century Byzantine composer Cassia of Constantinople, began mixing the parallel organum style with the drone style. Cassia's haunting music has recently been recorded for the first time in 1,000 years, and it rather gracefully refutes the assumption that the development of early music is exclusively the handiwork of men. These new layered sound effects, built on plainsong tunes, were edging very close to what today we would call harmony, that is, the existence and exploitation of simultaneous clusters of notes. This was the first giant step our medieval ancestors took as the year 1000 loomed. The other was to alter the course of music history dramatically. It was the invention of a reliable, universally adopted musical notation. It took an Italian monk, immortalized as Guido of Arezzo, to crack the code in around AD 1000 and give Western music its unique system of notation, still in use today. His system was an iteration of an earlier attempt at transcribing melody, and it's worth tracing the journey from the wholly oral approach to the written down approach. What singers of plain chant had in front of them in the centuries before about AD 800 was the text in Latin of what they were singing, just the text. They had to memorise the melody. There were, for example, 150 psalms in the standard church repertoire, all of which had their own melodies. Some of the longer ones had multiple melodies in sequence. Added to this were prayers, responses, canticles, hymns, and the words of the various masses, several thousand different tunes for the church calendar, many of them, thanks to the puny 8-note pool available, worryingly similar to one another. This is one of the most spectacular feats of memory in the history of the human race. But it's also a bit mad. So it was deemed highly desirable to find a way of reminding singers what the tune of any given passage might be. Medieval musicians started their quest by adding what looks like shorthand to the text. The oldest surviving manuscript of two-voice parallel organum in the world can be found in the Bodleian Library, Oxford, as part of a book called the Winchester Troper. It's 1,000 years old, roughly contemporaneous with a report of an organ at Winchester Cathedral that boasted an extraordinary 400 pipes. If you thought that the departure of the Romans caused the British Isles to descend into mindless savagery that wouldn't be reversed until the Norman Conquest in 1066, think again. Winchester's Troper of two-voice organa manuscripts and its mighty 400-voice pipe organ were the work of Anglo-Saxon Christians. The Winchester Troper shows Latin text that was intended to be sung, with various accents and inflections above it and in the margin, to indicate to the monk or nun what kind of melody they were supposed to be chanting. The Troper is not unique, though. Between about 650 and 1000, an ad hoc system of small, above-the-text markings became more common in chant books all over Western Europe. The markings were called neumes, from the Greek word pneuma, meaning breath, and they were probably inspired by similar markings in the Masoretic Hebrew texts of the Old Testament, which were transcribed between the 7th and 10th centuries, and by subsequent archaic Latin translations. Vowel sounds weren't written out in ancient Hebrew, so the accents and markings around the text indicated correct pronunciation and instructions for chanting. Similarly, neumes were there to give some indication of whether the note of the melody went up or down on any given word, and they were certainly a step in the right direction. Neumes did, though, have one major flaw. They were essentially a way of jogging the singer's memory, reminding him of a tune he already knew. They couldn't help him sight-read a new tune from scratch. Rather like a road map with all its place names removed, you could see all the features, the musical rivers and roads, but with no clue as to where this all was in relation to anything else. Neumes were really just for people who already knew the way. Various musicians attempted to formulate ways of improving the neumes, including a 9th-century French monk called Hucbald, who suggested giving specific note pitches an alphabetical name, A, B, C, D, E, and so on, as we still do today. To be fair, Hucbald merely experimented with this concept rather than invented it. It had been circulating in musical theories since antiquity, as indeed it had in Indian and Chinese musical systems. He also toyed with the idea of having the words move up and down with the shape of the tune. Perhaps, not surprisingly, this didn't catch on. Enter, at last, Guido of Arezzo and his remarkable breakthrough. His job at the cathedral in Arezzo was to train the young choristers, and he'd calculated that teaching them the whole of the church's plainsong repertoire by ear, parrot fashion, would take over 10 years. What he desperately needed was a method of notation that you could read and turn into singing at sight, and he set about developing this miraculous time-saving device. His methods were simple and clear. First, he gave the neumes a standardised, easy-to-read form. Each note had its own identifiable blob, a mark on the page, and they were placed in the order, from left to right, in which they were meant to be sung. He then drew 4 straight lines onto which the notes would be placed so that it was instantly possible to see the relative positions of every note. These days we call the collection of lines a stave or staff. He coloured the second line from the top red in order to give each tune an absolute bearing in relation to all other tunes. The position of each note represented its pitch position, that is, whether it was an A, a B, or any other note. If the tune went up, the notes went up. If it went down, the notes went down, step by step. This method has been refined over the years, for example by altering the blob shapes to indicate the duration of a note, or to group notes together in clusters to pick out a rhythm, and in time his 4 lines became 5, but it is essentially the same system for notating music as is used universally in the 21st century. Guido had given music its map at last. From now on, around AD 1000, you could write down a tune and someone else could sing it back to you, never having seen it or heard it before. It was a revolution. Within a century, Guido's notation started popping up in monasteries almost everywhere, except in the Eastern Orthodox Church, which stuck with its neumes. One of the most important consequences of the notation revolution was the way it changed how music was created. Instead of thinking up a tune and then teaching it to everyone you know and hoping they pass it on without modification to everyone they know, generation by generation down the ages, a composer could now place music, like words, on a page. It would stay unmodified forever, as long as the paper didn't disintegrate. The ability to do this encouraged a far more ambitious approach to music than anything that had preceded it. A story that has to be memorised and spoken out loud is necessarily less complex than a novel that can be written down and unfolds over a greater length of time. So it was with the complexity of music following the invention of musical notation. So much so that, not long after notation became generally available, we start seeing the names of composers attached to pieces. This is no coincidence. If you can write something down, you can claim it as yours. Try claiming an idea as yours just because you told it to someone down the pub. One of the first named composers worth knowing about was a woman, a spectacularly clever and imaginative German woman, Hildegard of Bingen, who was born in 1098. She was also a scientist, nun, poet, visionary, and diplomat, and her music is still performed and admired now, nearly 1,000 years later. Hildegard's imaginative, lyrical, and reflective music represents a fulcrum between two eras. It still essentially sounds like a colourful variant of plain chant, but she embellished the outline of the tune with touches of her own. Whereas the vast body of church plain chant that existed prior to Hildegard sounds, intentionally, discreet and anonymous, her poetic sacred songs have a character, a style. She was well known in her own time. Born of the nobility, she became abbess of a thriving Benedictine community she herself had founded, situated on one of Europe's busiest arteries, the River Rhine, where she was visited by many pilgrims and prestigious guests who subsequently spread word across the continent of her scientific, political and artistic works. She corresponded with the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor. Significantly for music, she was one of the first composers in a new trend that sought to move away from the conformity and rigid tradition of plain chant by adding ornamentation and melodic detail that lay outside the strict confines of the standard method. Instead of handing on the tried and tested chants, as had been the norm in earlier centuries, Hildegard made up her own chant tunes. This seems to us an obvious thing to do, but in the 12th century it was both daring and unexpected. The revolutions in both notation and harmony during this period had been hundreds of years in the making, but once they were in place, the pace of innovation accelerated rapidly. The development of layered voices and notation ushered in a period of great experimentation and adventure, particularly with regard to harmony. And because of them, Western music by 1100 was already utterly distinct from every other musical culture that had ever existed. Within Hildegard's lifetime, a group of younger composers working at Notre Dame in Paris had become known for their radical approach to harmony. The trailblazer of this group was called Léonin, and by the standards of the early 12th century, he was both